Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, a special two-hour Valley Edition that looks at the aftermath of last week's election. We'll discuss what a Trump administration means for the Valley and also look at some races closer to home. Evan Onstad of KC24, John Ellis of the Fresno Bee, and Fresno State political scientist Lisa Bryant will join us. We'll also talk to country music icon Ray Benson. His band Asleep at the Wheel is keeping the Western swing legacy of Bob Wills alive and well with an infectious blend of country, jazz, and boogie-woogie. He plays the Crystal Palace in Bakersfield this weekend and joins us later in our program. And in a little bit, we'll hear why some people think a recent change to some popular brands of corn masa could help prevent birth defects, especially in Tulare County, which has the highest rate of spina bifida in the state. That's coming up in a little bit. We begin our program today, though, on a different health issue. Valley fever has long been a major health concern for people who live in the San Joaquin Valley and throughout the Southwest. A fungus that grows in the soil can become airborne. If inhaled, it can cause serious health issues, even death in some cases, though most people who contract the disease have a mild case and they don't even know they've had it. Valley fever is the subject of a new collaborative reporting project, which Valley Public Radio is a part of, from the Center for Health Journalism Collaborative. It includes a number of publications, including the Bakersfield Californian. Joining us on the phone now, we have Harold Pierce, who's a reporter with the Collaborative and the Californian. Harold, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Joe.
And also joining us in our studio today is FM 89's Kerry Klein, who is also a part of the Collaborative and who has a piece coming next week on this topic. Kerry, welcome as well.
Hi there, good morning.
Harold, I want to start to you. What's going on with the rise or potential rise in the number of new cases of Valley fever? I'm seeing this word epidemic being thrown around. What's the rationale behind that and what's happening with the numbers?
Right. Well, where we're at right now is we're in an epidemic threshold, and what that basically means is that we're seeing more cases than we would in a routine typical year. Through just June this year, they saw about 890 cases, and a typical year in Kern County where they like to see it is right close to 500. That's pretty average. So we've already surpassed the threshold. We're in epidemic status, and they're saying with the weather patterns the way they're at right now, they're going to be looking for closer to 1,800 to 2,000 cases by the end of this year, which is huge. I mean, we haven't seen that many cases since the early 90s when they had the what they call the Great Epidemic.
And I want to talk about that in a little bit and how the weather plays a factor there. But before we go on, Harold, most of those cases that we're seeing statewide, most of those are in Kern County, as I understand it?
All 890 are in Kern County, and this is the most endemic region in California, is right here in Kern County. The other big endemic regions throughout the nation are Arizona and other parts of the Southwest. They also get some cases, not a lot, but some cases up in Washington, Oregon.
Now, it's been a big issue for some time, and getting more attention to it has been a big part of the challenge. 3 years ago, Valley Public Radio, the Californian, and others were involved in this collaborative project that did a lot of different stories about Valley fever. Kerry, for those listeners who may be not aware about the details of this disease, you know, it sounds kind of innocuous, Valley fever. Is it just a matter of having a temperature, or what happens when somebody contracts Valley fever?
No, absolutely not. It can be so much worse than that. It can also be a lot better than that, which is part of the reason that the disease can be so insidious. So as you summarized nicely, it's a fungal disease. It's contracted when you breathe in the spores, when they're kicked up in dust or soil, things like that. Around half of the people, it's believed, who contract the disease show no symptoms whatsoever, which is one reason that perhaps the disease is underestimated. But among those who do get symptoms, you know, they range from kind of flu-like and pneumonia-like. It's often misdiagnosed as flu or pneumonia, it will go away on its own, but it can become, a much worse lung disease, causing lung problems. It can become disseminated, get into your bones, cause meningitis. In very rare cases, people do die from it.
We're talking about Valley Fever here today on Valley Public Radio and this new project from the Center for Health Journalism Collaborative, which this station is a part of, detailing the new looming epidemic. We're talking about this rise in cases right now. Harold Pierce with us on the phone from the Bakersfield Californian, who has done a lot of reporting on this. Harold, you mentioned climate and weather and comparing it to the great epidemic back in the 1990s. Tell us about that and how people think those two things are related.
Yeah, and this has been something that's studied not just from the 1990s, but back going to the 1940s, studying these weather patterns, because as Carrie Klein had mentioned and laid out, this is a fungus that grows in the soil, spores get kicked up, and the idea behind it is that when you have a long period of drought or rain, the rain grows that fungus in the environment, the drought dries it out, and then when the drought comes, it kicks that soil up. And when you have construction, agriculture, tilling, things like that, that leads to more disturbance in the environment, more possibility that Coxsackie fungus gets kicked up into the air, and a greater potential for people to breathe it in. So that's kind of where the weather patterns play. We saw this El Nino come in last year, and as a result, we're seeing a lot more Valley Fever cases now because it's dried out since March.
So when we look back to the 1990s, was that tied to the drought that we had and then that very wet March
that
miracle?
March miracle, right.
Is that the
right
theory, essentially?
That is the exact theory, yes.
When it comes to looking at that then, are we at a point where we can actually predict a Valley Fever outbreak, or is it more complicated?
It's a lot more complicated than that, you know, and I think that people would like to be at the point where we can predict it. And I think a lot of doctors can, you know, go out on their own and say, we're going to see a lot of Valley Fever cases this year. And this has been a year that people have been, you know, who are involved, experts, researchers have long predicted we're going to see a lot of cases, a huge spike. And we have. But conclusively, can we say it? No. And that's because dirt and dust and soil is so unpredictable. They tried doing studies like this over at CSU Bakersfield, and they were not successful. They couldn't actually create that correlation because the dirt and the Coxsackie in the soil is so unpredictable. I mean, there's too many variables at play. You could have more construction in a given El Nino year that's dried out than you do in another one. So it's not necessarily a guessing game, but it becomes more difficult to say conclusively, yes, we had an El Nino and then we had a dry period. It's going to be a big bad year for Coxsackie.
Again, we're talking about Valley Fever today. When you say Coxsackie, that's another name for Valley Fever, right? Explain that.
That's the fungus, yes.
The fungus itself that lives in the soil. Carrie, in reporting on the stories that you're working on this, and Harold, you as well, how challenging is it to report on this disease? What's the biggest hurdle? Because it seems like there's a lot of things involving reporting or data that in some cases is not there or hard to interpret. Carrie, I'll let you go at this first.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge amount of data that's missing because it's so difficult to know, because this is it's a disease that is caused by something that is endemic to the soil in various regions. It's hard to know just how many people are exposed, just how many contract it and don't show symptoms. For other diseases who affect the same number of people, many of those other ones have had more research funding. And so there have not been maybe the amount of clinical trials that we would like to see about methods of prevention and treatment and detection and things like that. And I think that, one of Harold's stories actually he may get into a lot about what's missing as well. And so I don't know, Harold, if you have more to add to that.
The data reporting is kind of a mess. And what we found in this project is that the numbers that are reported to the State Department of Public Health don't match the numbers that are reported to the local departments of public health. They don't match the numbers that are reported to the Centers for Disease Control. Nobody seems to be working from the same set of data. And part of the reason that is because there's a lot of lag time in between not only when somebody contracts Valley Fever and then when somebody actually is diagnosed properly, because like it's been said earlier, a lot of this is misdiagnosed for pneumonia or bronchitis. Usually you're misdiagnosed diagnosed for several weeks before you actually get it down properly. So there's a lot of a lag time with data as well, with the actual reporting process at these at the state centers.
Now, Harold, you mentioned that there were 890 confirmed cases of valley fever in Kern County through June of this year. But then fast forward into September, numbers reportedly spiked there. What happened in September?
Well, in September, that's just a big year for valley fever. And I think it's worth noting that 890 cases are what's reported through the Kern County Department of Public Health. If you were to look through the numbers through the morbidity and mortality weekly rate studies that the Centers for Disease Control puts out, they reported 455 cases. So that's where we're talking about this huge disparity in the numbers. But what happened in September is we had a huge dust storm on the 28th here. And I think we're going to see a lot more numbers spiking in October because of that. And like I said, these numbers aren't readily, you know, you don't see a dust storm and then immediately have, you know, a surge in cases the next week. It takes a few weeks before those things actually get diagnosed properly. Lab tests come in. But September and October are typically the two really, really high traffic months for valley fever. I think not just throughout California, but also in Arizona. And in Arizona, they're actually seeing lower numbers this year. I think they have 1,000 fewer cases they've reported this year as opposed to last year because their monsoon season lingered a little bit longer, is what we've been told. And because of that, it dampened the coxie into the ground. Dust wasn't kicking up as much. And consequently, they have had fewer cases.
Now, you talked to somebody, a retired public health official from Kern County, who had his own theory about valley fever and climate. Tell us what he thinks is going on.
Yeah, Ron Talbot, he's an interesting guy. He's a retired lab director and epidemiologist from the Kern County Department of Public Health, and he's living in Arizona now, and he still keeps up to date with all the valley fever research. And what he had been tracking and studying for years on kind of a side project in his own was linking wet and dry years to valley fever incidents. And what he found is I think that any time in March and April that there was more than 4 or 5 inches of rainfall throughout the county, that you saw a spike in numbers in September and October. He linked those things, and he saw it in the early 90s. He saw it again in the 2010s, and we ran the numbers this time around, and it came very close to that. So I think there's probably a correlation, but a scientific one that we could say definitively, I don't know.
We're talking about valley fever today and this new project that has a number of different media organizations working together, including the Bakersfield Californian and Harold Pierce, who's with us on the phone, and Valley Public Radio's own Carrie Klein. Carrie, you have a story coming next week. Tell us a little about what you'll be sharing with us on next week's program and then what this overall collaborative is all about.
Sure, yeah. So the story next week kind of deals with the fact that a lot of people have developed immunity, or many people, I should say, have developed immunity to valley fever. And so a lot of projects are trying to focus on how to detect that immunity among people and to know who is more or less susceptible to the disease. So the story next week is focusing on one method for detecting that and why it maybe is not being used as much as a lot of doctors expect that it would be at this stage.
Sounds very interesting.
Yeah, so that'll be next Tuesday. Harold also has a story next Tuesday about these kind of gaps in data and reporting. This past weekend is when we kicked off the series officially. And so, Joe, as you said, we have 7 different outlets who are contributing, reporting to this series. Bakersfield Californian and KVPR, of course. There's also Vida and El Valle here in Fresno, The Voice of OC in Orange County, Arizona Daily Star in Tucson, and Radio Bilingue in Fresno, and La Estrella de Tucson, and the Center for Health Journalism. All of these together are kind of presenting a package of stories that will cover this whole topic holistically, from, you know, where Harold's story kicked off this past weekend on how the numbers have changed and the disease burden has changed over the years. We're also going to focus on research funding, efforts to prevent, treat, and detect the disease, and also focusing a lot on the specific people and communities and groups that are affected most by valley fever.
Well, Valley Public Radio's Carrie Klein, we look forward to these stories coming out over the next few weeks, including on this program. Again, it's Just One Breath, a new project about valley fever from the Center for Health Journalism Collaborative. Harold Pierce on the phone and Carrie Klein with us in our studio today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Finding the perfect doctor can be a feat for anyone, but for LGBT people living in rural places like the San Joaquin Valley, finding an understanding physician can sometimes feel impossible. And as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, some say visiting a doctor's office is so intimidating that they often go without care.
In 2014, Visalia pediatrician Catherine Hall got fed up.
Pediatrics, this is Dr. Hall's office. How may I help you?
She sees her practice as welcoming to LGBT people, but she felt that conservative values and homophobia in Tulare County have kept many from receiving proper health care.
Many of the physicians I know are LGBT-friendly, but patients don't know that and are very afraid that they're being judged.
That's why she wanted to create a list of LGBT-friendly doctors. To find them, she sent a survey to over 500 Tulare County doctors and got about 120 back. The survey asked a few basic questions, like would you welcome LGBT people to your practice and would you be nice to them? Most of their answers were yes, but so many never sent it back.
And I made the bar very, very low because we just didn't get much education on LGBT health in medical school. That is starting to change.
Fast forward 2 years, and Hall is now volunteering at the Source LGBT Plus Center in Visalia. The Source opened earlier this year under the guidance of Nick Vargas. The 30-something recently moved back to Visalia from the Bay Area to start a second career. As a sexually active gay man, Vargas wanted to get on PrEP. It's an anti-HIV medication recommended by the CDC that keeps HIV-negative people from being infected.
You can find something like PrEP here, but access to it can be a little hard.
Vargas said he had to teach his physician about the drug, and it took him about a year to consistently get on it. That process is something he didn't have to go through in the Bay Area.
Once you tell them, they want to be able to help, but they have to ask for it, and then they have to learn how to administer it, how to follow up. And that's a process, and it's out of the scope of what they normally do.
Stories like Vargas's are all too common in the Central Valley, according to Mario Alfaro with Planned Parenthood. As a community educator for the region, Alfaro says fear of judgment is a big concern to LGBT people, especially in rural places.
They tell us, I don't even come out to my clinician. I don't tell them anything. I don't want to feel judged. It's my only health center out in my region. I can't get to Fresno. If I come out to them, they might judge me, and then all of a sudden, the only doctor I could go to has closed their doors.
I found stories like this in my reporting as well. I met a lesbian woman in her 60s from Bakersfield who's never been asked about STDs. Gay men facing HIV issues, and transgender people being refused care altogether. For some, it's an issue of distance to care providers who will gladly help them, and for others, it's an issue of cost. Dr. Sue Stone is an LGBT-friendly physician in Fresno. She says her patients travel from as far as Merced to see her.
I mean, the Valley is so conservative. It'd be really scary to go to many doctors and say that you're gay, and especially for men. Gay men have such unique health care needs.
Needs like blood tests and PrEP because of higher rates of STDs. I found Dr. Stone on the list of LGBT-friendly physicians in the Valley. As I called through the list, I was shocked that several people who answered the phone didn't know what LGBT stands for. Dr. Kathy Kimball with Planned Parenthood in Fresno says this is a perfect example of why people travel from as far as Tehachapi to see her. She says they might be able to make their first appointment, but continuing service is hard to maintain.
They just can't get here every 3 to 6 months to get their medications refilled and make sure their labs are okay. I think that's the hardest part, is seeing the outlying areas not getting any services.
Kimball has seen more than 200 transgender patients this year alone. Lots of these people are forced to come to see her in Fresno because many physicians in rural places aren't comfortable caring for transgender people. Sherry Donegan is a transgender woman that recently moved to Los Angeles from Fresno because she had one too many negative experiences here, like this.
She was my primary care doctor, and the front office staff says, we don't serve your kind here. And they said, if you don't leave, we're going to call the police. So I left. It's been very, very hard and very, very difficult.
All the physicians I spoke with say situations like Donegan's could have been handled very differently. Perhaps a referral, the proper use of preferred gender pronouns, and kindness from nursing staff. That's why Dr. Catherine Hall says cultural sensitivity trainings for staff and simple changes to make lobbies comfortable for everyone are imperative.
Physicians often don't recognize that they are not being inclusive or sensitive to LGBT people's concerns. So there is often a disconnect, and that's where more education would be helpful.
And even though there's a lot of confusion around what doctors see because of either perceived homophobia or real anti-gay sentiments in the Valley, Hall says it won't take that much training for doctors and nursing staffs to create safe spaces for LGBT people to receive care. But changing attitudes, at least in some parts of California, will take much more. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. If you look at the nutrition label on a loaf of bread, you may come across folic acid or folate. It's a vitamin that in pregnant women has been shown to reduce debilitating and sometimes fatal birth defects. For decades, folic acid has been added to some foods, but not others. Now, as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, a new FDA decision to expand those foods could bring the vitamin to more people in the Valley.
Graciela Soto is the mother of three in Woodlake, and like a lot of parents, she wants a car that can accommodate her family. But she has a unique set of needs. Her daughter Chantel is in a wheelchair.
I'm looking for a ramp. How complicated is it to use that?
They're very simple. We teach you how to use them to lock the wheelchair in.
11-year-old Chantel is getting too big to be lifted in and out of their current car. I met up with Soto at an event in Tulare for individuals with disabilities, and she was getting information about vans equipped for wheelchairs.
Do I need an appointment? Can I just walk in?
You can walk in. I recommend calling ahead of time.
When Soto went in for her first ultrasound 12 years ago, she was shocked to learn her unborn daughter had spina bifida. It meant her spinal cord wouldn't develop properly. Spina bifida is one of a family of conditions called neural tube defects, and studies have shown that taking folic acid can prevent most of these defects, if the mother starts early enough.
She was my first child, so I didn't know any better that I was supposed to be taking folic acid before my pregnancy. Maybe had I taken the folic acid prior, maybe she wouldn't have had this diagnosis.
Folic acid is added to grains like wheat and rice flour in breads, cereals, and pasta. But Soto's diet is based less on wheat and rice flour and more on corn masa flour.
Tacos, enchiladas, corn tortillas. Like you would eat bread in a meal, but we eat them for breakfast or lunch or dinner.
Unfortunately, Soto's not alone. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say Hispanic Americans are at higher risk for neural tube defects than other ethnicities, and the risk is even higher for those born in Mexico. But earlier this year, the FDA approved fortifying corn masa with folic acid, and a prominent masa manufacturer has jumped on board. It's a series of events that was many years in the making and is poised to have an impact right here in the San Joaquin Valley.
So if you look at the spinal cord is encased in a rim of bone.
Patricia Clerkin is a pediatric neurosurgeon at Valley Children's Hospital in Madera. She says in spina bifida, the spinal cord doesn't close properly, and part of it may actually extend outside the body.
You have kids without any problems to kids who are profoundly debilitated, paraplegic, to kids who do not survive beyond the first couple days of life.
Those who do survive require a lot of specialized care. Valley Children's is one of the few medical centers in Central California with a dedicated spina bifida clinic. Clerkin says the clinic has over 1,000 patients, some of whom drive in from as far as Sacramento and San Luis Obispo.
It's a very chronic problem, and it is a large part of this hospital and this practice.
The condition is rare. The CDC estimates about 1,500 people are born with it each year in the U.S. In the San Joaquin Valley, the rate is highest in Tulare County. Most of those cases are among Hispanics. Still, the numbers are lower than they used to be. Products enriched with folic acid, mostly with wheat flour, hit the shelves in 1996. Since then, the CDC estimates that spina bifida cases have dropped by over a third. Folic acid supplements are available, but some women don't know to start taking them early.
Unfortunately, it is important to be taking the folic acid before conception, so food is critical.
But women who don't rely on wheat flour have been left behind. Sarah Strewey saw the need for more fortified foods. She's president of the National Spina Bifida Association. In 2012, the association teamed up with March of Dimes and other groups to petition the FDA to get folic acid in corn masa.
It started with a series of phone calls that led to face-to-face meetings and getting individuals who were doing research at CDC involved. And it really gelled as a group. We were able to come together and make a big difference.
4 years later, in April of this year, the FDA announced it would expand its recommended fortifications to include corn masa flour. It's voluntary, but the world's largest masa manufacturer has already committed to it. The Mexican company, Gruma, produces brands like Mission and Guerrero tortillas and Maseca corn masa. Gruma promised its improved foods by the fall, and fortified Maseca, at least, has already been rolled out. For some families, it's just in time for cooking homemade tamales for the holidays. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Stay with us. There's more of Valley Edition coming up in just a moment as we look back to last week's historic election. We'll talk about national politics with a local perspective, learn what the Valley could be in store for with the Trump administration, and dig into some local contests as well. That's our all-star panel coming up in just a moment on this special two-hour Valley Edition here on FM 89.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4, and it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
Until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition. Up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen tomorrow.
Listen weekdays, 3 a.m. to 9 on Valley Public Radio.
The quest for the perfect backpack is ongoing. This is the one I took to the Grand Canyon.
Hey, it's Carrie Klein.
And Ezra David Romero. We're the hosts of Valley Public Radio's podcast, Outdoorsy.
I sat in Little Eden and there was a snake in it when I was there.
Oh no.
In each episode, we bring you to wild places in Central California.
That was a challenging hike.
Yes.
Yeah. Find the podcast at kvpr.org or on iTunes.
We'll have a new episode every month or so.
It's such a beautiful place. It just restores you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This morning's program is a special one. We have a two-hour show today as we take a look back at the election now. In a moment, we'll be joined by special guests Evan Onstad of KC24, John Ellis of the Fresno Bee, and Fresno State political science professor Lisa Bryant. We'll get their thoughts on the aftermath of the election and what it means for you. Of course, no one has a crystal ball, but the impact of a Donald Trump presidency on the Central Valley is a big topic of discussion. Modern American presidents have broad powers that they can put into effect quickly. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess brings us this report looking at four key issues where a President Trump could act decisively and on his own.
Some of the bigger promises made by President-elect Trump will require the cooperation of the Republican-controlled Congress. Promises like a border wall, mass deportations, and repealing Obamacare will take some time. But with the stroke of his presidential pen, he can bring sudden and consequential changes that could reverberate throughout Central California. One of the biggest changes could be to the distribution of water to farmers in the valley.
If I win, believe me, we're going to start opening up the water so that you can have your farmers survive, so that your job market will get better.
That was Trump speaking at a rally in Fresno in May. Ryan Jacobson with the Fresno County Farm Bureau says the Obama administration has chosen to pump less water and give smaller allocations than they are legally allowed to. Jacobson says the worst impacts of the drought are being exaggerated by those rules, and that Mr. Trump understands and could act to fix that.
There are not necessarily set numbers. There's ranges. The current administration has, for the most part, pumped at the bottom of those ranges for quite some time, for the most part. And we're hoping, obviously, just small increases in that will make significant differences down here on the farm.
Jacobson also thinks that having a Republican Congress and president could go a long way toward passing a much-discussed California water bill that would be more favorable to the needs of farmers. But there's another side of Mr. Trump's promises that unsettles people like Jacobson and could impact the farm economy, immigration. Mr. Trump has been firm about this point, like when doing an interview with CNBC this summer.
They're going to have to go and they're going to have to come back in legally.
And otherwise, we don't have a country. And if we don't do that, we don't have a country. They're going to have to go.
Mass deportations of undocumented Hispanic immigrants would deeply upset the workforce needed to cultivate the produce. The threat of deportation is already terrifying both documented and undocumented residents, says Jesus Martinez with the Central Valley Immigrant Integration Collaborative, or CIVIC. Short of mass deportations, Martinez says, Mr. Trump could act by reversing President Barack Obama's executive order that protects from deportation some 27,000 undocumented immigrants in the Valley who were brought here as children.
Because it allows individuals who came here as very young individuals to actually have a chance to integrate themselves more effectively into American society and economy. And to deny them that chance at this stage is, I think, really, really sad. It would be a very sad chapter in American immigration history.
There's a third action that could have tremendous consequences for the Central Valley farm economy, trade. Trump has staked out a protectionist position on trade, promising to slap tariffs on goods from countries he feels are undermining the American economy, like Mexico and China.
This wave of globalization has wiped out totally our middle class. It doesn't have to be this way. We can turn it around, and we can turn it around fast.
Gary Huffbauer with the pro-free trade think tank, the Peterson Institute for International Economics, wrote a widely cited paper in September forecasting the potential consequences of what he calls a trade war with other nations. Huffbauer says the Central Valley is uniquely vulnerable to job losses caused by a trade war because farm goods are very easy to target if other nations fight back and stop buying our produce, which he says could trigger a serious economic downturn.
Nearly every county in the valley has employment loss of close to 4%. The lucky ones, maybe only 3%. That's a pretty big impact. That's recession time.
Huffbauer says when it comes to trade, any president has a level of discretion on increasing tariffs without congressional approval that rivals his ability to command the military, meaning he can act unilaterally at any time. Not everyone in agriculture fears Trump on trade. The California Citrus Mutual put out a statement on Monday welcoming Trump and downplaying policy concerns, saying, quote, he is not against trade, but he does desire better trade agreements. He is not against immigration or immigration reform, but he's for secure borders. Finally, a central promise of Mr. Trump's campaign was the complete repeal of the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. Here's Trump during a CNN town hall.
First of all, I have been so against Obamacare from the beginning, as you know. Repeal and replace.
About 500,000 Central Valley residents found insurance coverage through the ACA's combination of subsidized private health insurance and expanded Medi-Cal. That's coverage they could potentially lose if Congress sends Mr. Trump a bill repealing Obamacare. But John Kabat-Zinn, a professor of public health at Fresno State, says there are many regulatory rules on health care that the executive branch sets. Things like changing what insurance plans are required to cover and when hospitals are considered nonprofit.
So our hospitals have made, real efforts to try to understand that law and comply with it. But those are regulations and comply with them. And so they could potentially all change under a new regulatory scheme.
Still, Kabat-Zinn says because there is not a well-defined plan to replace Obamacare, there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty about the local consequences of sweeping away the ACA. President-elect Trump built his campaign as an outsider, ready to shake up Washington's establishment. How far he's willing to push that authority could have big consequences very close to home. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
And we continue our discussion about last week's election now live in studio with our guest panel, Lisa Bryant, Fresno State political science professor, Evan Onstott of KC24, and John Ellis of the Fresno Bee. Lisa, I want to start with you. A surprise seemed to be the word of the evening or early morning last Tuesday, a week ago, and that really was the word of the week. A lot of people in the media, there's been a lot of hand-wringing, people saying the media didn't, A, do a good enough job informing people about Trump. And on the other hand, people are saying the media didn't do a good enough job expressing the will of middle America and voters outside the big cities. What do you think happened there? Should we have been as surprised as we were in the quote-unquote establishment?
as someone who was surprised, I think that
We probably shouldn't have been as surprised. So polling has taken a big hit, and media relies heavily on polling, and it's taken a really big hit in this election, saying, oh, they completely didn't call it, they were really off. But if we actually go back and we look at the polling numbers objectively, you know, a lot of those races were predicting, you know, 1 and 2 point leads by Hillary Clinton, 3 point leads. I think her peak was about a 6 point lead. You know, so most of the time it was within the margin of error, suggesting this was a really close election. I think that, you know, part of the reason that we missed it and there was the really big shock factor was that Trump said things that were so sensationalist that that got all of the attention, that it sort of threw everybody off, and that really led the conversation about Trump and Clinton. And I think that some of the things, you know, were not typical American values, things that we normally hear out of presidential candidates. And it sort of threw the media, academics, general society maybe off in terms of how well those things resonated with middle America.
Evan, what do you think? Do you think we're going to see as much reliance in the media on predictive polling? Because actually, if you look back at those polls, or at least those predictive analysis statements of these polls, technically they were all right. Very few said there was a 100% chance. So as long as you leave the door open, I guess you could say, sure, well, we were still right.
Sure. And when you factor in the point that Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote by not a little bit. I mean, it's going to be, I think, 1.5 million, something like that.
Almost a million.
Yeah. Almost a million right now. The national polls were technically right. I just think, and I would love for the media in general to stop worrying about polling as much. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love for that to happen, but we've seen this play out in race after race after race, year after year after year, cycle after cycle. The media needs those polls because we have the 24-hour cycle that we have to feed, and the beast needs to get fed. And the easiest story to do time and time again is the horse race. How's it going? Who's raising the most money? What do the polls look like? I think we might see a shift to more online polling because, as we saw here, there was just a lot of people who were apparently unwilling to tell the pollsters over the phone that they were going to vote for Donald Trump. The discrepancy, we were talking about this, between for Hispanics in their polling – post the exit polling coming out of it showed something like 19% or 29% voting for Trump. But then the Hispanic media, the Telemundo, the Univision, their polling showed half that number voting for Trump. So who's right? It just depends on where the opinion's coming from, who wants to know.
John, do you think it's almost a reverse Tom Bradley effect?
I mean, we're still talking about polling. I just think, you know, there's your polling models too. And I mean, what do you think? And I mean, polling overestimated the Latino turnout. I think it wasn't there. But then again, Trump just won. He won more votes, I think, than his base was more motivated. And obviously, I think Evan's right that people, they voted for him when they didn't tell pollsters they were going to vote for him. I just think it was politically incorrect, and people, I think, in a way, they're angry, but they didn't want to say they were angry.
Yeah.
And when they got in that, you know, in the privacy of the voting booth, you can do whatever you want to do. But I think to your original point, too, yeah, like, you know, like Nate Silver, I think, you know, he has always been like, he's been so famous because of what he did in 08 and 12. And you're right. He never said it was, I think he gave Clinton a 2/3 chance of winning. And he had Florida at 50-50. He had North Carolina at close to 50-50. I mean, those were on the edge. I mean, they could have really, he had them shaded slightly blue. So I think Hillary Clinton was at like maybe 52%. So Trump was at 48%. I mean, those are essentially a coin toss states. And when they go in the Electoral College, when they go, those are big numbers. When those states go for Trump, it really starts swinging the pendulum. I think the surprise probably was Michigan,
Wisconsin,
Pennsylvania. Maybe not so much of a surprise, but certainly I think really it certainly appeared it was going to go for Clinton. But I think these Rust Belt states are the places that I think caught everybody by surprise. Those are the ones where I think everybody thought those were going to be. Well, not Ohio, but I think those that were more solidly Clinton states.
And I want to move on now from election night to this last week as the fallout has been happening. The transition team is assembled. We have two Valley congressmen who have big roles here, one on the transition team now with Devin Nunes. He brings to the table, obviously, agriculture connections and foreign policy experience with the intelligence chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and then, of course, with ag and water. But then you have Kevin McCarthy, House Majority Leader. I want to play a clip from Kevin McCarthy. This is from Fox News Sunday. Him talking about Donald Trump's border wall. It seems to be changing a little bit. Let's play that now.
I believe you have to have a security all the way through, but when you look at the border, and this is something that the House knows a great deal about because we've actually worked on this and passed it through committee. When you look at a wall, but you also have the technology today with UAVs, you can look out 40 miles ahead. The terrain is different, so you can't always build in just a specific place, but you can protect it. The number one thing we need to do is protect our border.
That's different language than Donald Trump used on the campaign trail. Congress certainly is its own animal, but are we going to see, John, the president-elect, maybe walking back a little bit on some of these things?
I think we all know that Trump is completely unpredictable. His history, he always talks about the art of the deal, right? That's his deal. And deal-making means cutting a deal. It means compromising. It means if he is the deal maker that he claims he is, certainly I think in dispute somewhat, but I think certainly his supporters would say, he is the deal master. Then that means that you compromise. I mean, that's what making deals is all about. And certainly though, and I think in the private sector, and he is the CEO of his company, you can say this is the way it's going to be, and it is that way. We all know that that's not the way politics mm-hmm. works. But on the other hand, cutting a deal means your company is trying to cut a deal with another company, you're trying to buy it or whatever you're trying to do. It's a work in progress. It's a deal, and in deals there are compromises. And so I think Trump is going to walk back all kinds of things. I don't really know what he's going to do.
It's not even an issue of is he going to walk it back. He already is walking it back, and not just the wall, which on the 60 Minutes interview, it's no longer a wall. It's a wall, and it's a fence, and it's whatever else it's going to take, that virtual wall that Kevin McCarthy was talking about. So I think that we have to be prepared, and I think what McCarthy's doing is he is protecting himself already and other Republicans from any sort of backlash that people might have. Like, hey, wait a minute, there's going to be a wall and Mexico was going to pay for it. How many times was this said during the campaign? It's obviously not going to happen that way. I mean, at least it's very, very likely that it's not going to happen that way. And so they have to protect themselves.
I think water is something else that we should. To me, that's the big thing. I think everybody thinks around this area. So in the Rust Belt, it's manufacturing. Here, it's water. I think there's a tendency for people to think, oh, Trump's elected. He's going to get us more water.
There's this giant wheel in the White House that he can just twist to the left and it just flows the water.
And a lot of this is established law. And I mean, certainly Congress can pass laws and Trump can sign them in this. But, so if you want to build Temperance Flat, that's an expensive project. And it doesn't necessarily mean it automatically is going to happen because Trump's there. The San Joaquin River Restoration Agreement, for instance, which Devin Nunes and some of the conservative members of the Valley congressional delegation, they hate that. But that was a settlement. Otherwise, it was going to be we were going to get hammered. I mean, the judge was going to completely come down on the side of the environmentalist because of established law. The Delta Water, which would help the West Side, turn on the pumps. Well, Trump just can't turn on the pumps. There is established law that has to be addressed. And it would be if Congress passed a law, it could be challenged through the courts. It could go to the Supreme Court. So he gets to replace, Scalia. But it's still we're back to where we were at, which Anthony Kennedy would be the swing vote. So and he's kind of swung both ways. So it is so hard to say that you can't just say this is going to happen. And I think Kevin McCarthy may be smart to try to say, let's walk this fine line, because I think you need to tamp down expectations. You can't just wave a magic wand. That's why checks and balances are in place. And that's why the founding fathers set up the government the way they did.
I mean, every president suffers from this, though, right? So we even have a term, we call it the expectations gap, that you make campaign promises that are in no way feasible to keep. And so, the wall is one of those promises that anybody who knows anything about congressional budgeting and how approval actually works know he was never going to get that wall approved. I mean, that feeds right into the expectations gap. This is a great rhetoric that really motivates people and energizes people, and yet there's no way that Trump could ever actually get that without the support of Congress. And Congress knows they don't have the budget to support that.
And that's the frustration, because that was one of his, what I think people would say, one of his top three campaign promises.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's go ahead and play another clip now from Kevin McCarthy, this time talking about health care.
What he really talked about was keeping pre-existing conditions and staying on your parents' health care plan to 26. Those are actually Republicans' ideas, and those are in the health care replacement plan that Republicans have in a better way.
So what kind of position does this put Kevin McCarthy in terms of being majority leader? You have in the past candidates who have rode a wave of populism in the House, and then that populist, Tea Party groups, others who have quickly turned on them when expectations weren't met. What kind of position with things like health care and talking about appealing Obamacare, repealing rather, in this case, walking that back a little, does this pose an interesting political dilemma for House Republicans?
I think it does. I mean, I think, you know, the election for 2018 started on last Wednesday, right? And so they need to position themselves in a place where they say, okay, Trump might be there for 4 years or Trump administration might be there for 4 years, but I have a reelection in 2 years. And so if we go back on everything that we campaigned on, if we all of a sudden aren't repealing Obamacare and we now spin it to, well, we're going to keep the good parts. We don't actually know what our replacement plan is yet. You know, people are going to become sort of disillusioned with this wave of change pretty quickly. And so I think that they're going to have to come up with some strategy pretty quickly to show we are making some of the changes that we promised on. Because otherwise, I don't think that McCarthy's vulnerable. I don't think Nunes is vulnerable. But maybe somebody like Valadao could end up being in a vulnerable position in 2 years.
You know, we keep saying that. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Valadao being
vulnerable.
Well, I think
let's wait and see what happens in 2020. The census numbers, the redrawing of the districts.
Sure.
Section 5 taken out of the Voting Rights Act. Kings and Merced no longer have to stay whole. I think we're going to see vastly different congressional districts after 2020. But, yeah, I agree with Evan. I mean, I think David Valadao is very safe as long as his district is what it is.
You know, about Obamacare and covered California and how that could all shake out, what people want, they want lower premiums. I mean, we're paying so much. You know, we just had to re-up at my work. And, you know, it's incredible the amount of money that you have to pay. And it's going up. Just to cover your family
with
less coverage. And so people want lower premiums. But when one of the things is that they're not going to take off the table, and that's the pre-existing coverage. Well, that's one of the reasons why it's so expensive, because when they have to insure people who have expensive coverage, that's one of the reasons why the rest of us have to pay a lot of money. So people need to understand that these are complicated things, and it's not just an easy thing of waving that magic wand and coming up with something great, as Donald Trump has said. It's going to be interesting to see exactly how this all unfolds.
Medicare, too, is something. I mean, the Republicans are really after Medicare, I think, and I'm kind of curious to see how that shakes out. I mean, honestly, that is an area where you could see some change. And how does that affect the growing number of baby boomers who are hitting 65, thousands per day, if not more? I mean, and are just, the wave is coming. It comes all the way, you know, till those who were born in 1964 hit 65. And I mean, if you're going to mess with Medicare, which is one of their core areas, I don't know if they're going to replace it with some sort of a voucher where you get a certain amount of money back. I'm not quite sure what the Republicans have completely in their idea book there, but you start messing with the older voters and you could get a backlash there too.
I was going to say there are very few interest groups that get as easily mobilized as AARP and the NRA. And so if you are going to ruffle the feathers of AARP members, their voters are vocal and they will reach out regardless of party. You know, keep your hands off my Medicare. That's one of the bipartisan positions that we still have in the United States.
You're listening to a special two-hour Valley Edition post-election special. I'm Joe Moore, John Ellis of the Fresno Bee, Lisa Bryant, Fresno State political science professor, and Evan Onstott of KC24 and host of Sunday Morning Matters on the station. Join us now. John, I want to follow up on something you said in terms of knowing what the Republicans' plans are. This Trump win being such a surprise, at least among the establishment out there, includes the political establishment and some Republicans as well. Did this win in some way catch even Republican inner circles off guard? And were people prepared, even in the party, for a Trump win legislatively to have things ready to go? Even on the transition side, there are so many positions that need to be filled in the White House. Do you think that's an issue?
Yeah, I think a lot of people the day after say, I told you so. But I think deep down, even around here in Fresno, you know, a lot of people like Steve Brandow, for instance, on the Fresno City Council, I think there was a fair amount of gloating being done by him on the day after. But deep down, I don't know. Did Steve Brandow really believe that Trump was going to win? Honestly, I don't know if Devin Nunes did. I don't know if McCarthy did. I think a lot of these people tended to believe. I think it just didn't seem possible, I think, for most people to believe that he actually would win, even among the Republicans. And I think there's going to be there could be an internal battle going on between, you know, the Trump people and the establishment and the Tea Party. You could see this fracturing, internal fracturing in the party as we go on. So
I don't think we're going to see it. I think there is internal fracturing right now. I mean, it's a fractured party. Don't get me wrong. The Democrats are a fractured party, too. Both parties have a lot of work to do. But I don't think that it's going to become more fractured. I think that they have to figure out how to come together and heal pretty quickly, because I think they already are fractured.
It's so funny.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's just so funny because going into this election, what was the big storyline? It was, how is the Republican Party going to repair itself? Is it even going to survive? And now with this Trump win, now it's the Democrats looking at themselves and being like, oh, my goodness, what's wrong with us? What do we need to do? And so there's some serious soul searching in that party as well. But you're right. It doesn't necessarily change anything about the Republican Party that had that fracture. It's still there. But there's a giant big Band-Aid over it right now that, you know, that's kind of right. Making everybody feel a lot
and
better.
I think they're scrambling.
Themselves.
They're scrambling. We won. Now we got to govern. Now we got to put together these ideas. But then you have these competing factions. I don't think it's not going to be as easy as it sounds. I think when they really start fighting in Congress and the Senate, you know, I think you still have some senators over there that are skeptical of Trump, even though they're Republicans and he won. The senators are a little more insulated than the House members are. They only get elected every 6 years, and it's a little harder to take them out. So I do think and there's still filibuster rules. It's going to be an interesting dynamic to see how it works out.
We have a few minutes left before we go to a break. But really quickly, Devin Nunes, we mentioned him on the transition team, chair of the House Intelligence Committee. House rules, John, we were talking about this the other day. In Republican rules, I should say, limit the number of years that a ranking member can be on that committee, ranking or committee chair.
But Devin reminded me the other day when I talked to him on the phone, intelligence is exempt from that rule.
Oh, really?
I didn't know it.
Interesting.
That's what he told me. Yeah. Intelligence is exempt.
So,
but he's also on Ways and Means. Let's not forget, he's very high up in Ways and Means. So if he wanted to, which I think, you know, you remember when Bill Thomas was a congressman. You know, I think everybody down in Bakersfield remembers the days when Bill Thomas was congressman because he seriously brought home the pork.
They're building the freeways right now.
Really benefited. You can see, still Bill Thomas's ghost in a good way still is benefiting Bakersfield down there as far as transportation dollars go and the freeway building and some stuff that's been going on down there. So if Devin wanted to move over there, but there's even this rumor floating around about Nunes going somewhere in the Trump administration.
I was just going to say, do you think we might see a secretary position? Maybe not.
Well, I don't
right
think
now,
that might be a little high. Let's just say, you know, he's intelligence. Let's throw out something like CIA director. I never know.
He's so well positioned right now. And he is really one of the only Valley congressmen who backed Trump and stayed with him the whole time. Everybody else ran away from him because of his political situation and his ability to back Trump without any sort of recourse. He is the guy now, at least in this part of the country, that can stand with him. And he's already, as you said, well positioned. So this, I think people who didn't know who Devin Nunes was around the country, they're going to get to know that name a lot more in the next 4 years.
But he does call it the chance of a lifetime right now, the opportunity of a century, whatever, to change things. So
sure.
He may just want to stay where he's at.
It'll be very interesting. We'll continue our politics talk in the next hour on the special 2-hour Valley Edition election special. And we'll be back with more of our discussion with Lisa Bryan, Evan Onstott, and John Ellis. Also later in the next hour, country music legend Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel. He's coming to Bakersfield this weekend. We'll talk about him and the legacy of Western Swing that's coming up in the next hour on a special Valley Edition. Stay with us.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Ray Kroc didn't start McDonald's, but he made it what it is today.
He went to the brothers and said, hey, look, I think this is a great idea. Let's sell it elsewhere.
A new book tells the story of Kroc and his wife, who left $200 million of their fortune to NPR. That's next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now starts this morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
My first car was a 1985 Mazda GLC. basically a tin can with a very small four-cylinder engine and a four-speed transmission. Popped out a whopping 63 horsepower, topped out at about 55 miles an hour. It was impossible to get any type of speeding ticket in this car, although my sister managed it. I don't know how she did that. By the time I got it, it had about 175,000 miles on it. Each one of my sisters crashed it. I crashed it. I think my mom even crashed it. It kept rolling along. I stuffed an oversized sound system into it to the point where the engine was making a rattling noise, and I decided, you know, it's not going to worry about it. It's almost got 200,000 miles on it. Just turn up the stereo. By the time I took it in, two of the engine mounts had broken, and the engine was partly resting on the transmission.
Go from tune-up to tune-in. Your car, truck, even that boat that won't float can make great radio. Visit the membership tab at kvpr.org and click on vehicle donation for details.
After Megyn Kelly of Fox News asked Donald Trump a tough debate question last year, he attacked her. Then came Trump's supporters and their threats.
It was my year of guards and guns, you know, thanks to Trump. I was under security threat for most of the 9 months he was really coming after me.
I'm Kelly McEvers, Megyn Kelly on her Year of Trump. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you'll find All Things Considered each weekday afternoon from 4 to 7 on Valley Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition, a special two-hour post-election edition of our program today on KVPR Fresno and KPRX Bakersfield. I'm Joe Moore. Joining us live in our studio today, we have three guests, Fresno State Political Science Professor Lisa Bryant, Evan Onstott of KC24 and host of the program Sunday Morning Matters, heard every Sunday on KC24. And then John Ellis of the Fresno Bee talking about the local consequences of last week's election and more. I want to now turn to the issue of turnout. What do we know about that right now, and specifically Latino turnout? We heard all these theories for the last few months about how, especially in the Valley, anti-Trump voters would flock to the polls, many of them Latino, because they would want to cast a vote against Donald Trump. That didn't look like it happened, at least in large numbers like people predicted. What happened there, Lisa?
I think that the Clinton campaign and the Democrats in general were reliant on the fact that people would be mobilized by an anti-Trump vote. But I don't think that Clinton in general gave Latinos a reason to vote for her. You know, and so I talk all the time about how people want a reason to vote for something. They want something, not to sound cliche, but they want something to believe in, something that gives them an alternative and an option. And so I don't know that voting against Trump is actually enough reason to mobilize new voters, right? You might be able to get active voters or low propensity voters, people who are already part of the system, to come out and turn out. But I don't know that you're actually going to mobilize a lot of new registrants and get a lot of new people to turn out based on that kind of rhetoric. And I think that that's one of the reasons we talked about earlier. I think Evan mentioned that Trump got, you know, 30% of the Latino vote. That's pretty typical, actually, in elections. So Obama got, 71%, I think, of the Latino vote, but Romney got 29%. It's pretty typical. So the numbers that we're seeing follow a pretty consistent pattern in U.S. turnout. But, you know, I think that that's part of the reason that we didn't see more turnout, was that I don't think Clinton really courted Latinos very well. I don't think she really gave them a reason. She was just reliant on the fact that Trump's rhetoric would drive them to her.
John, what are Democrats going to be looking at when it comes to candidates in the future in strategizing on that issue, turning out the base? Certainly Barack Obama, especially in 08, to a lesser extent in 12, brought out voters to the polls for the first time. Is it just about having this charismatic candidate? Or is there something else that they're going to be looking at? Because even locally here in Fresno, you heard people say, oh, Fresno is there's a change looming, and Democrats are on the rise in Fresno, and we're going to have the first Latino mayor. That didn't happen, and by a good margin. What is going on there?
Well, this is not even a new issue. I think people have been baffled continually. I've been at the Bee 17 years, and I think they've been talking about this coming Latino wave ever since the day I arrived, and it has yet to arrive. So I think the Latinos, for whatever reason, are not going to the voting booth that represents their numbers in the population, which is growing not just in California but all across the nation. I mean, talk about a political force waiting to be tapped. It is certainly the Latino population. But they just, first of all, they don't seem to be voting. Secondly, so let's look at, I was thinking like a couple of years ago in Amanda Renteria when she ran against David Valadao. So they thought she was a good fundraiser. She was well-spoken, highly educated, and a Latina in a district that is Latino dominated, the 21st congressional district, and she got thumped soundly by Valadao. Well, part of the reason, and I'm told this by Democrats who worked in her campaign, Latino Democrats who worked in her campaign, they found that Latino males don't want to vote for a woman, so they vote for Valadao. That's part of the reason. It's not the only reason. So I don't know. So I'm wondering if I'm just wondering if we can extrapolate this out to the national stage and say maybe that some Latinos voted for Trump because he's a man. And it's just a cultural thing. And I was told this. I was told this by Latino people, Democrats who worked on the campaign. So I don't want to say like I'm just making up stuff. So I thought it was struck me as interesting as one of the struggles as the Democrats fumble around to try to strike on something that they can put together an effective coalition to win races.
Didn't seem to help Emilio Huerta, though.
No, and it did, and you know, it's just like Valdeo's killed everybody. And I mean, I think what you have is you have the part of the 21st is the old school, the old line white Democrats from Oklahoma, Texas, the ones who were Democrats here when John F. Kennedy ran for president, when Fresno County was also blue because of those old Southern Democrats. They're Reagan Democrats. They're voting for Valadao. They're probably not going to vote for any Latino. Highly doubtful.
You know, to give credit to Valadao, though, I think that he really sort of embodies the delegate model of representation very well. I think Valadao does really, I think he does right by his district, and I think that resonates with voters. I mean, and so even if we think about, you know, he was one of 7 or 8 Republicans, I think, a couple of years ago to break with the party to say, you know, we can't be so hard on immigration. We need to create a path to legalization. And I think that that resonates with people in his district, both in ag, people who are reliant on immigrant labor, but also people who live in the district that might have immigrant families and things like that. And so thinking about him not behaving so much as a partisan all the time, but actually trying to appeal to the people of his district, I think Valadao does a really good job of that, which makes him safe. You know?
I think on the question of why aren't we seeing the Latino wave that we've been hearing, I think people need to feel like their vote counts. Like when they vote that it's going to matter for something. And I think, and it's not just for Latinos, but for a lot of people, they just don't feel like their vote matters. That the people that they're voting for don't represent their true interests. And I feel like that was a big part of what you're seeing from a lot of traditional Democrats, that they just felt like Hillary Clinton at the end of the day just did not represent them and their economic interests. I just think that she spent so much time railing against Donald Trump's personal limitations and his problems personally that she dropped the ball on getting out that economic message, which Donald Trump hammered, and he hammered to the end, whether or not he's able to deliver on that. But he was the one with the consistent messaging, and that helped with Latinos, and that helped with non-urban whites and all that.
And let's see, Obama had hope and change, and I think let's give him credit for being a good candidate. I think Hillary was a relatively weak candidate. Obama gave a positive message, and he was there at the right time. Mm-hmm. Things were really bad, and I think Republicans had wore out their welcome. Now, had Democrats worn out their welcome now? I don't really think that they had. I mean, really, the Obama presidency has been actually, I think, by and large, pretty good. I think a lot of Republicans listening right now probably would say, oh, no, it wasn't. But I think, you know, if you look at the facts, it seems like it's been a fairly good presidency considering where he started.
But the income gap is still there.
It is.
The stock market's going up, but the income inequality is still such an issue.
And the frustration in the Midwest is huge.
I want to turn to the Fresno mayor's race now. What went wrong for Henry Perea? He had an early, again, quote-unquote lead in polls. He was in first place in the June primary. The focus on water, Northeast Fresno water, was that a smart political move for Perea? Was it smart, John?
Well, so Perea, his son ran in 2008 and got thumped pretty good by Ashley Swearingen. And where he got thumped really good was in north of Shaw, the northern districts of northern council districts, Steve Brandow's district and Lee Brand's district. And so I think Henry felt that he had to move north and try to steal some votes away if he was going to win the election. it didn't. I mean, you know, so he tried to. I mean, that was a direct appeal to Northeast Fresno. I mean, it kind of fell in his lap like manna from heaven. You know, this issue was all of a sudden there it was. But I think maybe he didn't capitalize on it very well. I mean, putting water bottles on doorsteps with a political message, I just don't think that went over very well in Northeast Fresno. And you know, and this city is primed for a Latino mayor. Perea was very well known, but let's face it, the Perea name also has some baggage with it, you know. And I think if you look back to Henry T, I don't know if he ever called Ashley Swearingen and congratulated her. And I think some of this stuff is a hangover. The Perea name, even among some Latinos, even among some people south of Shaw, carries some baggage with it. Now, and Henry was, you know, he's a good, smart guy, and he probably would have been a good mayor. But and he's a good campaigner. But there are certain deficiencies, I think, in the Perea name and the Perea brand.
Well, you had the brand ads talking about the special election and the cost there.
Those were devastating,
Evan,
I guarantee you.
Was that a decisive or an important factor in the race?
I think Henry T. Perea leaving early the way he did has left a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths that fairly or unfairly leaked over to his father. Mm-hmm. And I think that in a year of change on the election, the Perea name was not, you know, it was kind of like the Clinton name. It's been there and people are ready for something different, even though a Perea has never been mayor before. You know, it's
but,
just,
but both father and son have been around. They've been on the political scene for
absolutely
so long. You can say, Evan, and that the fact, not only the fact that he saddled voters or residents of Fresno County with a $500,000 special election bill, but that he has $900,000 in his insurance commission.
It's still there.
It's just still there. This is Henry T. Perea, you know, and he's gone. He's a private sector now, and that money stays there.
And some of that money, I believe, found its way into his father's campaign.
Yeah, not
account.
A lot. But the legal amount. So he, you know, but it's perception. Perception's everything, and people just look at that. And like I said, and so,
but
it's hard enough.
It's North Fresno.
It's hard enough to get elected in the city for a Democrat from South Fresno. Add that to it.
I think the Perea's campaign had some of the same problems Clinton did, though, right? I think that he expected people were going to sort of flock to him, and he didn't have to work that hard to win their votes. And so if you think back to some of the events he did, you know, you said he's a good campaigner. I kind of respectfully disagree. I don't think he was a very good campaigner. I felt like often he put off sort of an air that he was actually disinterested. You know, he talked about some policies that I don't think people agreed with. He was against infill. He was about expansion in the Fryant Corridor. He talked all about Temperance Flat, what people had lots of questions about. And so I think that some of the policies that people like from the Swearingen, you know, reign, that some people like those policies and wanted them to continue. And so I think he did expect that people wanted change and that they would just flock to him, but I think that he was wrong.
Yeah, he ran on change, but I was surprised as much as he criticized Ashley Swearingen. I didn't expect that as much from him, and I think maybe that rubbed people the wrong way as well.
But I don't think infill is that popular in North Fresno. That's why I just think that. See, Swearingen, so the talk about bus rapid transit and infill, that kind of stuff, I don't know how much that is a campaign winner up in North Fresno.
We'll have to see how it plays out and what a brand administration means for Fresno City Hall, as well as a Trump administration. All conversations we'll have in the future here on Valley Edition. Thanks for joining us, our special panel, Evan Onstad of KC24, host of Sunday Morning Matters, John Ellis of the Fresno Bee, and Fresno State political scientist Lisa Bryant. Thank you all for joining us. Stay with us. Our special two-hour Valley Edition continues in a little bit. We'll talk to Fresno State Professor Lori Kloon about her new book about executing the Rosenbergs and country music legend Ray Benson. He's coming to Bakersfield this weekend at the Crystal Palace. We'll talk about the influence of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. That's coming up on Valley Edition.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Listen Monday through Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Valley Public Radio.
Thank you.
You're listening to a special two-hour broadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Later on this hour, we'll talk to Fresno State Professor Lori Kloon about her new book, Executing the Rosenbergs. Plus, Texas music icon and Grammy Award winner Ray Benson with A Sleep at the Wheel joins us. Much like his idol Bob Wills, he fuses country with jazz to form his own unique blend of Western swing. He performs in Bakersfield this weekend. He'll join us to talk about his new tour and his new record. Right now, though, we turn our attention to another part of the cultural scene in the Valley, poetry. This weekend, the Fresno State Master of Fine Arts Program in Creative Writing is hosting a showing of a new documentary all about Fresno State alumnus Larry Levis. The nationally honored poet grew up in Selma. To tell us more about the film, A Late Style of Fire, Larry Levis, American Poet, FM 89's Ezra David Romero spoke with the film's director, Michelle Paulos, and producer Gregory Donovan.
Tell me first a little bit about Larry Levis himself. What is he known for?
Larry Levis grew up in the Central Valley of California. He was born in 49 in Fresno, and he spent most of his childhood there working on his father's family farm. He grew up working alongside Mexican field hands, and those experiences were very important to him, and he later wrote about those experiences in his poetry and in his essays. Many of the poems that he is known for involve and are expressing and interrogating those formative experiences for him. He also writes about so many other things, but that's certainly one of the things that we see very often in his poetry. He studied poetry with Philip Levine and Peter Everwine and Charles Hanzelcheck. Those are all poets in the Fresno area, and they were very important to him growing up as well, especially Philip Levine, who became a brother in poetry and a lifelong mentor and friend. They exchanged poems and letters their adult lives. As Larry grew up, he continued his relationship with him, and they were very important for each other. And Larry then went on to teach. So he was a writer. He was a teacher. He taught at Virginia Commonwealth University. He taught out in Utah and a number of other schools. And he ultimately, sadly and tragically, died when he was just 49 years old while he was teaching at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia.
So what got you interested in making a film about him, documenting his life? What inspired that?
You know, I had been living in New Orleans, and I'd been studying creative writing there at University of New Orleans. I was starting a program there, and I actually moved to New Orleans about 2 weeks before Hurricane Katrina hit. And so that experience upended my whole life, as you can imagine. I left New Orleans, and I contacted some of the people, the teachers at Virginia Commonwealth University here in Virginia, and they very kindly and graciously took me in as a Katrina orphan. And so when I moved to Richmond, I was immersed in the literary community here. I met all kinds of people that had known Larry Levis. I met his ex-students. I met ex-girlfriends. I met, all kinds of people. And I was hearing all kinds of stories about Larry Levis everywhere I went, parties, events. People would talk about their experiences with Larry. And it really got me even more interested in his work and his life story. So I started reading a lot of his poetry, reading his essays, and became quite fascinated with him. And also I recognized that many of the people that knew him were getting older, and I was kind of worried that some of those really important stories would be lost. And I just ended up doing a few interviews with some people out here, And that kind of led into this whole five-year project.
So you sort of try to answer this question, you know, in the film, like, what am I willing to give to my art? And then, like, Larry gave everything. What did you discover in that sense, you know, about giving everything for art in this process?
Yeah, that was definitely one of the themes that emerged, is how much one is willing to sacrifice for their art. And, you know, I feel like the film asks that question, and people kind of weigh in. You know, there are various perspectives that are offered from some of the greatest living writers in the country about Larry Levis specifically, and about art in general. I mean, Stanley Plumlee in the film very pointedly says that, you know, one could argue that he feels that Larry Levis's story is a cautionary tale, and that he felt that it was a slow suicide. And then you have on the other end of the spectrum somebody like David St. John, or Larry Levis's sister Sheila, who says that it was a miscalculation. You know, it was an absolute miscalculation. He never intended to die. He didn't want to die. There was no death wish, you know, secret death wish or something like that going on. So you get a full range of perspectives in the film about that issue.
Larry was the most devoted writer I think I've ever known, and David St. John chimes in with that same opinion during the movie. He was willing to stay up all night in marathon writing sessions, and I often would, he was in touch with his writing all the time, and it was a constant part of his life, so that it affected his relationships, his love affairs and his marriages. It affected his friendships, mostly in a positive way, but because I loved going out to dinner with him, and he'd be talking about poems he was working on, and I'd talk about poems I was working on, and we had a great time doing that. But he also was willing to employ substances to keep himself awake and alert as he worked. And that turned out to be more of a problem, I think, than he ever imagined it would be.
What do you think Levis means to Fresno today, you know, looking back at his life?
I think that his work is extremely important to young writers and young people more generally who grow up in that area, because it gives them something to aspire to and be proud of. His many friends and, you know, fellow poets who live in that area and continue to teach there all find his work worth giving to their students and to the people they're mentoring because of that same reason. It gives them inspiration. It gives them confidence. It gives them something to aim toward. It's an unlikely story, I suppose, for many people that a guy could come from, you know, a very modest background, growing up among people who were not entirely, you know, sophisticated literary types or anything like that, although his mother was a great reader and she cared a lot about literature. But it might seem to people unlikely that a person from Fresno could end up becoming an internationally famous poet. But it never seemed unlikely to Larry himself, because he had Phil Levine as an example. So the effect of having such people as Phil Levine and Larry Levis come from or work in Fresno, California, gives people a completely different sense of what possibilities are there for them, I think. And it gives them a different sense of self-confidence as they move forward in their own lives, whether they're involved with writing poetry or not. It shows that being from Fresno is not really a limitation at all.
So tell me about the Fresno premiere. What can we expect? When is it?
The Fresno premiere is Friday the 18th at the Tower Theater, and it starts at 6:30. I will be there in attendance. Gregory Donovan, who you just heard from, will be there in attendance. He's the producer. He's also in the film. poet David St. John will be in attendance as well. He is in the, we interview him quite extensively in the film. And there will be a number of his family members there, friends, students from all over the area should be there. I think it's going to be a really good time. And also, I have to say that the Tower Theater, where we're holding it, makes an appearance in our film. It was one of my favorite shots because we did a time-lapse shot of the Tower Theater and the neon kind of ball at the top there. We spent, I don't know how many hours outside kind of doing this one time-lapse shot. But so that makes an appearance in the film. So I think that'll be fun to show the film there in the theater and see that scene.
We've been chatting with Michelle Poulos and Gregory Donovan. She's the director and he's the producer of a film, A Late Style of Fire, Larry Levis, American Poet. Thanks for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having us, and we hope to see everyone there.
You're listening to Valley Edition.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It was one of the biggest scandals the country had ever seen, the theft of U.S. government secrets about the atomic bomb that wound up in the hands of the Soviet Union. The federal government eventually tried and executed Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for conspiracy to commit espionage, sparking an international outcry. Now the story of the Rosenbergs is back in the news, as there's an effort underway to seek a presidential pardon in their case. There's also a new book about their trial by Fresno State professor Lori Kloon, who joins us now. It's called Executing the Rosenbergs, Death and Diplomacy in a Cold War World. Lori, welcome to Valley Edition.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I think a lot of our listeners probably know something about the Rosenberg case, but maybe even more of them don't know about this couple. The only couple, as I understand it, ever to be tried and executed by the government. Tell me exactly, what were they accused of doing?
So Julius, as we know now, ran a medium-sized military spy ring. And the reason he gets caught up in this particular case is his brother-in-law, David Greenglass, is stationed out at Los Alamos and passing some information to Julius, and then Julius is sending it on to the Soviet Union. When the federal government reacts to the Soviet Union testing its first atomic bomb in 1949 and says, well, spies must have been involved, they look to Los Alamos and find a couple of spies, most famously Klaus Fuchs. His information was crucial for the Soviet development of the bomb. But they look to and they see David Greenglass and they interview him, and he says, "Oh yeah, I passed on a few things." I mean, he's a mechanic, so it's not high level stuff necessarily. But he said, "Yes, I passed it to my brother-in-law, Julius." So then they arrest Julius, and they know because of some top secret documents that they can't disclose in court that he does run this medium-sized spy ring. So the whole thing is to get Julius to talk. So they arrest him. And he won't name the names of the other spies. They arrest his wife to pressure him to talk, as J. Edgar Hoover says, as a lever to get Julius to talk. This is all in 1950.
What charges she face?
Yeah, so they both are conspiracy to commit espionage, which is the easiest thing to get them on, because conspiracy is can be cognizance, right? Do you want to rob a bank? Let's rob a bank. If somebody's sitting next to me and they hear that, they are cognizant of the charge of the crime, and so technically could be conspiracy. So that's where it gets really technical, and the Supreme Court has certainly interpreted it in a couple of different ways, which is why, as we can get to, but the call for President Obama to exonerate is challenging because it's not very clear cut. So it's not conspiracy, or it's not espionage itself, it's conspiracy to commit espionage. And based on the size of their apartment, yeah, she was cognizant. It was a very, very small place. She knew what was going on and was likely very supportive. But she did not have a code name. And from most of the documents, she's not actively involved. In fact, she's spending most of her time raising two rather rambunctious sons, and that's taking up most of her time. In this, 1944 to 1950, roughly, period.
So we're talking about the initial spark of the Cold War here as the country began its Great Red Scare, and this trial happens. Your book focuses on the trial. Tell me about that process. A lot of these issues deal with government secrets and espionage by the U.S. government as well. Was there a tell me about the evidence presented against them.
Yeah, it gets complicated because there are things that can be used in court and things that cannot. So the big thing that cannot be used in court is something called Venona. And these are transcripts that have been ascertained by the federal government. But even President Truman didn't know of this program's existence. That's how top secret it was. And of course, those who are processing that information, it's transcripts of correspondence between the United States and Moscow. And they don't want Moscow to know that the United States has been able to tap into this information, so they can't disclose it in court. And, you know, in court, it's, you know, you have to prove someone guilty. There's an assumption of innocence. And so it's only because of David Greenglass, Ethel's brother, Julius's brother-in-law, because he's willing to testify, that this case can hold up in any way in a court of law. And so they've got David saying, yes, I spied and I gave the stuff to Julius. And initially he says, oh, no, Ethel had nothing to do with this in the grand jury testimony. By the actual trial itself, he has changed his tune and says, yes, she was involved and she typed reports. We know now that that was a lie. He admitted this in the year 2000 or so, 2001 on 60 Minutes, saying that, no, I lied to save the life of my wife, who actually was a spy and had a code name and actually passed on information. So the trial becomes, you know, his evidence is and testimony is key. But the problem is that this, you know, the Justice Department knows the other stuff. They just can't disclose it in the courtroom. And so they're securing a judge who will be willing to issue the death penalty because they want to use the death penalty, again, to further pressure Julius to talk. It's all about getting him to talk. It's not really about the quality of the information that he passed on. The atomic information particularly is not, it's not high level stuff. It did not save the Soviet Union much time at all in the development of the bomb. But it's something that David Greenglass can testify to. So that's why it's the focus of the trial.
Was it also a media circus to some degree?
Sure, because it's 1950. And the trial 1951, and it's in New York City. And we've just had the trial of the top Communist Party leaders in the same courtroom. Alger Hiss is being sentenced at the same time in the same building. So there's a lot of hype. And I think that's what the hardest part for me was to wrap my brain around. Because when you teach this case, students say, well, this is crazy. This is a couple living in the Lower East Side of Manhattan with two children. How did they, you know, give the Soviet Union the atomic bomb and then cause the Korean War, which is what the judge argued in his sentencing. And so you've got to put it in the context of the incredible fear and paranoia of the time. The belief, certainly by the Truman administration and by many Americans, that communism was on the spread, that now the Soviet Union's got the atomic bomb in 1949. China's a communist country now in 1949. It seemed as if communism was spreading. This was an incredible threat. And, you know, we look back now and go, sure, you know, we're going to duck and cover under a desk and that's going to save our life. It just seems so irrational. But fear is irrational. And I think the fear was palpable. And so the idea of we're going to get these spies because these are the ones we can get. And this will send a signal that these spies are guilty. And anyone who spies could get the ultimate sentence, in this case, of course, death. And that will prove to the world that we're strong. And we can fight the spread of communism. And that's the part I focus on, right? Because I argue because of these documents that they don't actually prove that we're really strong. We were very good at convincing the American people this is the right thing to do. But overseas, it's a different story.
Tell me about that reaction overseas and also here in the U.S. As this conviction was handed down and then the ultimate execution in 1953. What was the public response here and abroad?
Yeah, so here it's very, you know, if you look at Gallup polls and things, Truman, of course, his popularity is wavering a bit because of things that are happening in Korea and the Korean War, but it's never about the Rosenberg case itself. So his popularity concerning the case is fine. Eisenhower's popularity, I don't think, ever dips below 68%, which seems phenomenal today. It's such a high number. The vast majority of the American people believe that this is the right thing to do, that these people are traitorous, that they are spies, and that they should suffer the ultimate penalty. And so, if you will, if it's a propaganda campaign, if it's the spin of the State Department, and in this case in particular, the Justice Department, they do a really good job within the United States of convincing the Americans that these guys are a threat to our national security. Not a word we would have used then, but that's the sense, right? Overseas, even though Truman and in particular Eisenhower are known for their propaganda savviness, they are not able, either of them really, to get ahead of the spin and convince the world, both allies, folks in nations that we used to refer to as third world nations that are kind of up for grabs in the Cold War, come to our side, we're better than the Soviets. Those folks they're not able to spin the story to convince them that this is the right thing to do. And mostly it's because the evidence against Ethel is so weak. And that translates around the world to, what are you doing? She's a mom. And then the large amount of the global population who are opposed to the death sentence at all, that the death penalty is not what a democracy should be doing. So when the Pope comes out against their execution in January of 53, we get this flood of Catholic countries around the world saying, what are we doing? This is not what the United States should be doing. And so the Eisenhower administration at that point can't quite get ahead of, how do we convince them? No, killing people is bad, but this is worse because they're putting the entire world at risk. They can't sell it. And so we've got now, because of State Department documents that we were able to uncover, we've got about 48 countries, 84 cities that have documented protest movements.
We're talking with Fresno State Professor Lori Clune today on Valley Public Radio about her new book, Executing the Rosenbergs, Death and Diplomacy in a Cold War World. It's out on Oxford University Press. How much more do we know about this case now than we did back in 1953 in terms of documents that have come out, other revelations that have been uncovered through the press and through other interviews? And how much don't we know?
We know a great deal now, certainly more than the average American did in 1953, in part because of investigative reporting, in part because of the release of the Rosenberg sons do a Freedom of Information Act request and get their parents' FBI file released in the 70s. And that is, I think, 40,000 pages of documents. And that includes State Department stuff and FBI stuff and CIA stuff. And sure, a lot of redactions, but it fills in the story. When the sons were growing up, they assumed that their parents were honest with them when they said, because the sons were brought to Sing Sing prison to visit their parents while they were still alive on death row, they said, we're innocent. And so the sons really spent most of their lives believing that was true. Why would they think otherwise? The FBI documents proved that Julius ran a military spy ring. And he had many, perhaps a dozen engineers working with him, and they did forward information to the Soviet Union. So, but what the documents also showed was that Ethel was not really a spy. And so they continued this effort as more documents are released, as we get access to Venona transcripts in the 1990s, as David Greenglass is interviewed in 2000, 2001, and he admits, I lied about what my sister's involvement was to save the life of my wife. I had no idea that they would actually execute her. Though, to be honest, he doesn't seem particularly perturbed by that fact, which is a little disturbing. We get that information. We just keep piecing these bits together. When David's wife, Ruth, dies, her grand jury testimony is released. And that's revolutionary because that's when we find out that there is no mention of Ethel doing anything in the grand jury testimony, but she is mentioned in the actual testimony. When David Greenglass dies, we get his grand jury testimony that further confirms. So I suppose part of the final piece is that the documents that a wonderful archivist in College Park, Maryland, where the State Department documents are, when David Pfeiffer was able to find two boxes of missing documents that document this global protest movement. Because until we found those documents, we thought that the protest movement was maybe a couple of people in England and a few people in Paris, and that was about it. And now we know 84 cities, 48 countries around the world. And so that, I think, further tells the story of how this case was a blunder by the Truman and Eisenhower administrations, if the purpose was to convince the world that we're strong and this is the right thing to do, because they were not able to convince so many people around the world that this was the right thing to do.
Is there still information out there that researchers are looking for or hoping to uncover? It seems like in many cases the government maintains classified status on documents going well back past the lifetime of most people alive today.
Yes.
Is that the case in this trial?
We know a lot, certainly, but I don't want to say we know everything for sure. Things that have been redacted that we could petition to release those, we'd get further information. A real key is the Soviet archive, or the former Soviet archives, because those were open for a brief moment in time, and a few historians were able to go there and get some of that information. That's really key. Because it's from their perspective, who was spying for them and what were they doing? That window closed relatively quickly to former KGB documents. And so opening that up again would enrich the story much more.
So bring us up to the present day. The two Rosenberg sons are still alive. They were on 60 Minutes last month. I understand you actually did some fact-checking for that
piece. I did.
I
got to do fact-checking. That was pretty fun. The Rosenberg sons, I think, are remarkable. I don't agree with everything that they're doing, for sure, and that's fine. I mean, I'm a historian, and this is their family story. It's a very different situation.
Do they still maintain the innocence of both their mother and father?
No. So they were these are very smart, savvy men, and they acknowledged when the FBI documents were released that their father was indeed a spy. The execution is the part that really trips up a lot of people. That's hard to wrap your brain around. But they certainly continue to believe that the prosecution of their mother was untenable, that was beyond what was legal, certainly. And that's why today, so they were adopted. After their parents were executed shortly after. So their last name is now Maripol. And so Robert and Michael Maripol have petitioned President Obama to exonerate Ethel. And they want to say exonerate because pardon implies that she did something wrong and the president would pardon or forgive. Exonerate is she never should have been tried in the first place. And, I wrote a piece a while back, and actually Michael Maripol replied to me personally about my piece because he disagreed, but he was very gracious about it. But my problem with exoneration is that would mean there was nothing about what she did that could have been prosecuted. And because of the very woodgy kind of definition of conspiracy, technically her cognizance of her husband's espionage activities could be enough. In fact, indeed, it was enough to get her convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. So I'm not sure that exoneration is legal. I've read other people's interpretations that they say that it is. Other historians who have said absolutely not. Some historians think she was much more active than I believe the documents prove that she was. So it's an interesting case. It's certainly, I think the piece I wrote said exonerate Ethel, no, but apologize for her death, absolutely.
The book is called Executing the Rosenbergs, Death and Diplomacy in a Cold War World. It's by Fresno State History Professor Lori Clune, and it's available worldwide on Oxford University Press. Lori, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
This is Valley Edition. Fiddler Bob Wills was known as the King of Western Swing. He helped develop a style that fused country and big band jazz in the 1930s and made him one of the nation's biggest stars. While Wills always called his native Texas home, he actually lived in Fresno in the 1940s, and much of his band was from the San Joaquin Valley. Western swing has always had strong roots here. While Wills died in 1975, his music lives on through the artistry of people like our next guest, Ray Benson. For over 40 years, his band Asleep at the Wheel has been bringing Western swing to audiences worldwide to great acclaim, including Grammy Awards, 3 Bob Wills tribute records, and the honor of being named Texas Musician of the Year. Benson and Asleep at the Wheel make their way to the Valley this weekend for a show Saturday at Buck Owens Crystal Palace in Bakersfield, one that's sure to be special for a man who was also heavily influenced by Owens and Merle Haggard. Benson joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Ray, welcome.
Well, so good to be here on the radio, Joe.
Ray, I want to ask you, you've become such a big force in country music, specifically in Western swing. How does a Jewish kid from Philadelphia become so identified with the musical identity of Texas?
Well, you know, I spent, 46 years doing it. So I guess, that's how it works. I don't know. I just got interested in all kinds of great American Western music and just sort of took off.
You could have gone in any direction musically. I was reading your biography the other day, and all the various paths that you crossed or crossed yours from Taj Mahal to so many others, rock, blues, and beyond. Do you remember the first time you heard Bob Wills or Western swing? What was your reaction? Because this is the late 60s when rock and roll was king.
Yeah, well, I first heard Hank Williams, and a couple of his songs had, takeoff stuff, what I call, jazz kind of influenced guitar leads. And I had heard Hank Thompson, who had a more commercial form of Western swing. And then the first song I heard was Brain Cloudy Blues by Bob Wills and the Playboys, and I went, wow, because it incorporated everything I like, a little bit of the blues, a little country music, fiddle music, great guitar playing, and ensemble playing, So that's how it all came down. And I wanted to also be a country western singer and songwriter, and that's how it all happened, So we had a big hit in 1975 of the letter that Johnny Walker read. I don't hardly even do it anymore, but it was a country western thing, and I wanted to show that country music can come from anywhere in America, and it always has. The what I call the geographical imperative is sort of out of step. In other words, well, you have to be from Texas to play that Western swing. I said, well, if that holds true, then Van Cliburn, who's from Fort Worth and Shreveport, should be playing a Western swing. But he wasn't. He played country music, he played classical music because that's what was in his talent and in his soul, in his heart.
Back when you were getting into this music, swing-based music was kind of out of date or out of style. Was that part of the youthful rebellion, picking up on something that was not in favor, especially in the country music world at that time? Bob and swing-based things were kind of looked down upon, right?
Well, it wasn't looked down upon. It was totally ignored, but, we just loved the feel of it, the happiness of it, the danceability of it, And so as 18-year-old kid or adult he just wanted that feeling, We wanted to be able to play that music, but no, it was funny. When we went to Nashville to record in 1972, the old-timers heard that there was this band playing Western swing with old style instruments and everything, and not trying to sound like pop music, and they would stop by. They were like flabbergasted. They couldn't, you know, that this weird named band, you know, of young kids was playing the kind of music they had to have abandoned when rock and roll took over.
Now, about the same time you were doing this, Merle Haggard was also digging back into his roots and paying tribute to Bob Wills. But politically, Merle expressed a very different sentiment, at least in some of his most popular hits. What was your reaction to Merle back when things like the Okie from Muskogee and the Fighting Side of Me were on the radio?
Well, I started trying to put the band together in 1969, and actually did in 1970, in February 1970 or March. And in 1969, I had a job in New York City. I was going to be a filmmaker, and I was working for a famous guy editing a film. And I was in the cab going to work, and back then it was, you're either hippies or hard hats, you know. And Okie from Muskogee came on the radio, and I was like, what? Whoa, what's that all about? Merle Haggard, my hero, I love his music, and he's telling me to get out, you know, because I was opposed to the Vietnam War. That was part of the impetus of this going, wait a minute, you know. And then on the other side, the rock and roller guys were going, well, you know, if you're against war, you play rock and roll. If you're for the war, you play country music. So we were stuck right in the middle of that whole thing, and some days we would play in like 1970, 71, and they'd go, play rock and roll. And then other places they'd go, in West Virginia, like we had to, you know, fight our way out of the bars when we started playing the country western bars, you know. But pretty soon we won everybody over on both sides with the music, you know. That was the whole idea.
I want to talk about the Bakersfield sound. How influential was the music of Buck Owens, Merle Haggard, and the others who called Kern County home to you? And how do you look back on it today?
Well, as I told Buck when we became great friends, was Buck Owens' record of Buck Owens live at Carnegie Hall was our Bible. And Merle Haggard's tribute to Bob Wills was our other Bible, and they brought those were the two records that Asleep at the Wheel lived with and started, our band with. That was our aspiration, was to be as good as those two records. And I was in 1971. We wound up backing up Stoney Edwards, a great black country singer, and we went to Nashville with him in 72 to the, or maybe it was 71, I don't know, 72 to the DJ's convention, or 71, I'm going back and forth, but anyway, it was so long ago, and we opened up the show backing up Stoney with the Buck Owens show, which was Buck Owens, Buddy Allen, Susan Ray, etc. And I became good friends with Buddy. I got to meet Don Rich and hang out with Don. And these were our heroes. Musically, there was nobody better than Buck Owens and the Buckaroos with Don Rich and Tom Brumley and some of the greatest steel guitar drummers, etc. Everybody, you know. And, of course, Merle, what can I say? You know, he was my inspiration, and again, we became good friends and worked together many times.
A few years ago, there was an event in Bakersfield, a panel discussion about the Bakersfield sound, and the lament was, what happened? Where did it go? Where did Bakersfield's country music scene go? And there, to be fair, there are still some bands who are doing great work and keeping the sound alive, but when you look at the clubs, the Blackboard's no longer there. Trouts is still alive, but the scene sort of went away as musical tastes change. You're out there in Texas, in Austin. Austin was cited that night as an example of how to keep things going. And how do you think Austin has managed to not only keep its country music scene going, but make it thrive so strong?
Well, first of all, it was an organic kind of thing that just sort of sprang up. But it has a great history. So does Bakersfield have a great history. But the difference was is that people stayed here and grew out of it. And then we nurtured the community. You know, know, I'm talking about, you know, having big events. Willie Nelson, of course, was one of the first, you know, who just did so much for this town, and would have, you know, the picnic every year and bring people in. And then we started Austin City Limits, the television show, you know, in 1975. We did the first show. My roommate was the booker. We knew everybody. And we just were doing it for fun and had the opportunity. And, you know, so that helped spread the word. And then we really supported infrastructure. For instance, me and a bunch of people started a thing called the Health Alliance for Austin Musicians. We give out health care and dental care and mental health care to over 2,000 struggling musicians in Austin, Texas. We have, when we built the new airport, you know, I have a small bar in the airport, and we said, we'll do this, but we want to have a stage for music. There are now, I think, 3 stages for music in the Austin airport, which means during the afternoon they can go make some money, and that doesn't even impinge upon their nighttime gig, and also people buy their CDs who happen to be traveling through Austin. How all of these things are infrastructure, you know, I built recording studios so that we didn't have to go to you know. And Bakersfield had all that, but the one missing element is the audience. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that Austin's always had between the university and the high-tech community and the film community is people who will go out and support these local musicians who later become big stars, you know. But Stevie Ray Vaughan was playing little joints, you know, all over town. He was a good friend of mine, and who knew he was going to be the guitar legend that he is, you know. And I can name dozens of other bands that have come through. So you got to have an audience that goes out and sees this music. The Crystal Palace is such an incredible, you know, Buck Owens built it to always have a place where bands could play. But, you know, under normal business circumstances, nobody could build a place like that and make any money. Clubs are usually not that nice. That place is so beautiful and have such great, you know, restaurants because Buck wanted it to be that way. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of things. You also have to give a break to people who want to open clubs because they don't really make money in the sense of somebody says, well, I'm going to put money in here and then I'm going to make money on it. There's a whole lot of other better ways to make money with your money than to open up a music club. But it's a labor of love.
You've now done 3 tribute records to Bob Wills, let alone all the influence that he has on the rest of your music. You did them 3 different points in your career. How do you continue to find that music fresh and vital today? What is it about Bob's music and Western swing that keeps it fresh for you so many years in?
Well, it's dance music, so that means it's improvisational music, and that the instrumentalists in the band, the fiddle, guitar, you know, steel guitar, piano, horn players, have to improvise their solos, and that's like dessert for a musician, you know. That's okay. Show us what you can do and entertain the audience at the same time. So that's from the musical point of view. That's why I can play, you know, Miles of Texas every night and still enjoy it.
We've been talking with country music legend Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel. He's performing at the Crystal Palace in Bakersfield Saturday night. Ray, thanks so much.
Right on, Joe. We'll see you at Buck's Place.
Well, that does it for this week's special 2-hour Valley Edition. You can catch the entire program on our website at kvpr.org, including our recap of the 2016 general election, local and national races. As always, we want to know what you think. Email us, talk@kvpr.org, and send us a tweet @kvpr and @Valley Edition. Next week, we have another edition of our podcast, Outdoorsy, that's coming up on our program. So remember to find that on our show. And if you can't wait, you can find it on the website and at iTunes. Again, it's called Outdoorsy. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.